This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It was the moment that put Kamala Harris on the rise and Joe Biden on the defensive.
It was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
Senator Harris rose in the polls after that first Democratic debate. Former Vice President Biden has worked since then to defend his record and amend his errors. But step back from the presidential politics for a second, and you'll find an issue that bears unpacking: busing. It is one of the most contentious and revealing aspects of the fight to integrate public schools. Today, we'll answer your questions on busing, and we'll consider how far we've come in giving all children a great education, regardless of their race. Spoiler alert, those stereotypes about the North and the South are about to get shattered. Joining us now from NPR in New York is Dennis Parker, the executive director of the National Center for Law and Economic Justice. Dennis, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And joining us from WPSU Public Radio at Penn State is Erica Frankenberg. She is a professor of education and the director of the university's Center for Education and Civil Rights. Professor Frankenberg, welcome.
Thanks for having me join you.
We'd also love to hear from you, your questions or your thoughts about busing or your experiences dealing with busing as a means of school integration, how well it did or did not work, and what you learned from that. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Frankenberg, let's get a little bit of the background. Let's kind of set the scene for a second. First, here is a clip of a man named Troy Simmons. He's a school board member at the Longview Independent School District in Texas. He spent decades fighting for equality in education. He was interviewed by Aaliyah Swaby and Alexa Ura of the Texas Tribune. Here is part of their interview with school board member Troy Simmons.
Because people don't believe in educating all children. They believe in educating their kids, not your kid. I want my child to have the best education. I don't care what your kid gets. As long as my child gets the best. And that's the system we have set up. And it's built intrinsically, so people fight over that.
Professor Frankenberg, how much of what Troy Simmons said resonates with you in your research, this idea that parents want to educate their kid and not your kid?
I think certainly we've seen a shift in the last several decades in how we think about public schools, which of course are funded by our public tax dollars, into thinking of it as a private good, thinking about schools as a competitive marketplace and individual choice as being really an important and growing part of the school landscape. And in fact, this is quite ahistorical in terms of how we have for decades thought of or centuries thought of our public schools. That is, they were originally begun to educate and prepare the children for the community. And then in the Brown decision in 1954, they talked about the importance of educating students to be citizens in our democracy. And so really this rise of thinking about just trying to educate my child at the relative expense of others potentially is very new. And I think certainly does make it harder to try to achieve some of the goals of the integration movement.
Professor, is there a good way to define how segregated our schools are today in 2019? What's the best way to kind of quantify that?
Sure. I am the author of a recent report that looked at school segregation 65 years after the Brown decision, which was in 1954. And that was a decision, of course, that said that segregated schools were inherently unequal and really launched the current efforts for desegregation. We looked at a couple of different measures. One, the percentage of Black and Latino students in 90 to 100% non-white schools, and there is a growing percentage of students in such schools. It's also important to think about the segregation of white students. White students are also harmed by segregation. And there has been a decline in the percentage of white students in extremely white schools. But white students still have the lowest exposure to students of other races in their schools than students of any other racial group. And so this is really, to me, shows that we have growing trends of segregation and concerning difference in terms of the kinds of schools that students of different races are going to.
Dennis Parker, what's your sense of why schools are still so segregated? The Supreme Court demanded that integration be enacted through Brown versus Board of Education. Separate is inherently unequal. Are there one or two big factors, Dennis, as you see it, that have prevented integration from happening?
I think there are two things that really have prevented integration from happening. Number one is that we live in a country that is still very segregated in housing, and because school zones are determined by housing, that has an impact. But I think the second thing is that there is still enormous resistance to integrating schools, that there is still pushback. And, you know, you talk about this being 65 years since the Brown decision was handed down, and there was a full 16 or 17 years where there was massive resistance in the South to any desegregation efforts. The sad truth is that there is also resistance in the North. And if you look now, the states that are the most segregated are the states that we think of as being liberal states. New York has the most segregation for black students, California for Latinx students. So I think that there's still resistance to desegregation. You know, one of the things to remember is that millions of school children are bused every day. The only complaints, the only contentious things are when you're talking about busing for the purpose of desegregation. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that we have not advanced as far as we should have after that declaration by the Supreme Court 65 years ago.
So, Dennis, should we just kind of bottom line this? And I don't want to be too categorical, so correct me if I'm wrong, but should we just bottom line this and say that school integration has not happened because we still have a lot of prejudiced white parents who don't want their kids, or even flat out racist white parents, who don't want their kids going to school with black and brown children? Is it that simple?
I think that that is a factor, yes. And I think, again, part of the reason that I say that is that it's not limited to areas that we think of as being racist, that very often, even in progressive areas, you know, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Brooklyn Heights, there still is a resistance of many parents to send their children to school with black and brown students. So all of these things are continuing to be a factor. You know, the fact that we're talking about busing now, to me, seems like a diversion. What we should be talking about is the question of segregation and the question of discrimination and the current and the continuing legacy that those things have. Busing was just a tool to try to break down the system of white supremacy, which the Supreme Court identified in 1954. They didn't use those words, but they said that segregation was an indication that black students were regarded as being lower in the hierarchy. And they said that the damage that that did was so profound that it would affect students for the rest of their lives. They talked about a stigma that was unlikely to be undone. And in spite of the fact that we were talking about children who were being harmed in a continuing basis, there really wasn't meaningful progress to desegregation for more than a decade, well more than a decade. And there's still, as Erica said, there are still problems in this country of segregation and disparity of resources and educational opportunities.
And I do want to get to some of those other factors as we continue our conversation. But Professor Frankenberg, I don't want us to get too much farther without just being clear and defining that term. Give us a good, clear definition of what busing is and how busing works.
I think Dennis is right that busing, to some extent, is a political construction that we've used to talk about what is really resistance to going to desegregated schools. Busing is a tool that was used prior to Brown, in fact, to maintain segregation in the district that in Topeka, Kansas, where the Brown decision came from, Linda Brown was being bused past a white school to a black school. In many districts across the South, the one I grew up in fact, the same thing. A black student was being bused 17 miles to a black school. You know, so busing is not inherently something that is about desegregation. It's a tool that school districts use all the time. My three-year-old would love to ride a school bus right now, but she's too young. You know, so I think that we have to realize that we have constructed it to be something about to try to get white resistance to efforts to try to create desegregated schools. And what we need to focus on is how do we create desegregated schools, and keeping busing as one of those tools that we use.
And Professor, that term got kind of politically charged fairly quickly, right?
Absolutely. So certainly President Nixon was someone who talked a lot about forced busing in ways that connotated, you know, government overreach and was something that his administration was certainly against. And then there was the 1971 Swan decision from the Supreme Court from Charlotte Mecklenburg that talked about it's known colloquially as the busing decision. But of course, it really just talked about how you had segregated neighborhoods and the school district couldn't then rely on a pattern of neighborhood schools, because that would result in segregated schools, that they had to combine neighborhoods and, if necessary, use busing to take kids to a different neighborhood for integration.
Yeah, Dennis, I'd love you to break down the Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg case when we continue our conversation with Penn State Professor Erica Frankenberg and Dennis Parker, Executive Director at the National Center for Law and Economic Justice. We welcome more of your questions and thoughts as well, 1A at WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about busing in the United States and the larger efforts to desegregate America's public schools with Dennis Parker, the executive director at the National Center for Law and Economic Justice, and Penn State Professor Erica Frankenberg, who's the director of the university's Center for Education and Civil Rights. We'd love to hear from you, too, especially if you have stories to share about busing as a parent, as a teacher, as a student. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A at WAMU.org. Dennis, I should also ask you, Professor Frankenberg mentioned some of the experiences that she had in terms of school integration efforts. What about you? Were there any kinds of integration efforts, Dennis, like busing or anything else while you were in grade school?
Well, not really formally. My elementary school, and I went to public schools for the first part of my educational career, happened to be in a neighborhood that was changing, and changing rapidly. It had been an all-white neighborhood, and then, frankly, shortly after my family and a couple of others moved in, quickly became an all-black neighborhood. But the time I was in school was actually integrated because it was right in the middle of that change in that 10-year period when there was, at least for a while, integration. I did receive a scholarship to go to a private school that was actually 20 miles away, to which I took a train. I was the only black student in the class, so I would classify that as a segregated white school. And the school was excellent. It had great resources, but it was limited because of the fact that it was segregated. It is now a much more diverse school, and it is a better school because it is now diverse. The fact is, the students who were there in the time I was there did not get a full education because it was essentially a single race school, because they didn't learn from having people different from them. And I would argue that the white students suffered as much as I did, and the black students who didn't get a chance to go there. So that's really my experience.
Arthur wrote in our inbox, I experienced firsthand forced government busing as a student in the Portland public schools in the late 60s and early 70s. It did not go well. Even with forced busing, the schools remained segregated within, i.e. classes were not integrated. The students bused in took remedial classes and not college prep classes. African Americans and white students self-segregated themselves in the cafeteria. It was a turbulent time with lots of tension, not conducive to a learning environment. Professor Frankenberg, I'd love you to react to Arthur's comment, particularly because part of the discussion after the whole Kamala Harris-Joe Biden tete-a-tete was about voluntary busing versus mandatory busing.
Sure. And really, the busing that Joe Biden was against was busing to mandatorily reassign students, which is unlikely to be the case these days. I think the comment, though, is a really important one to help us understand, again, that busing isn't a magic wand that's going to solve our problems. Busing, again, is a tool to help get people of different races in the school together. But that in and of itself doesn't bring you the benefits that both Dennis and I have mentioned. You need to make sure that the classrooms are integrated, that you have a diverse faculty and staff that reflect the student body, that you are not tracking in ways that resegregate by race. And so it provides a necessary precondition to realize the benefits of integration, but you have to change the entire structure, and that's what integration was about. Too often, there was so much fighting over desegregation that schools, like the one that Arthur talked about, didn't reach that full integration and realize the benefits that are so important for equal status integration to happen. And I think some of the later episodes in terms of districts that, quite frankly, delayed longer could learn from some of the mistakes of the earlier generation. And so some of the voluntary efforts, for example, magnet schools, think about both how to attract students from different races, but also how to make sure that they're having equal experiences, that everyone has the same opportunities for college prep classes or electives, things like that, that are really important to the school experience.
Dennis, we mentioned the court case Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg. Tell us what that case was about and what came out of it.
The case was really important because it was, in essence, the Supreme Court saying enough, that it's time to actually do something. There had been a series of cases that were in the Supreme Court, in the federal courts in general, that resulted because of the resistance to the Brown decision. And the resistance was huge. In Virginia, a number of counties actually got rid of public schools and instead had publicly funded private schools. In other places, you know, students were greeted with hostility. School districts would claim that the schools were all open, but the parents of black students who tried to integrate schools would lose their jobs or be harassed. You know, school buses in some places were actually burned. There was enormous resistance. Some school districts had one a year plan where the kindergarten would be desegregated and then the next year second grade, in essence saying, we're going to take 13 years to do this. The range of ways that schools, that counties and school districts resisted the Supreme Court mandate to respect the constitutional right of black students was breathtaking. And the court had to keep striking down in a growing number of cases practices that continue to harm black students. And what happened in Swan was they said, as I said, enough, that enough time has passed that now you are going to be required to do whatever is necessary to desegregate the schools. And they talked about how you could use the whole range of options, rezoning, where you build schools, all of those factors, and if necessary, busing. Because they recognize that the problem of segregation was a deeply entrenched one, and that unless school districts were instructed to desegregate the schools, they would continue the resistance that they had practiced for, by that time, almost two decades. And I have to say that looking at my knowledge of the law, there are very few, if any, things like times I can think of where the Supreme Court said there was a constitutional right to something and that much time passed before mm-hmm. that right was guaranteed, even at the most basic level. So the Supreme Court was saying now is the time to do something.
And briefly, Dennis, before we move on, what's the legacy of Swan v. Charlotte Mecklenburg today? Does that decision still stand?
It does. Well, as Erica said, these cases were cases that were brought to address de jure segregation, states where they had laws that required separation. So there's a constitutional violation. Swan deals with what school districts have to do to remedy constitutional violations. There are still hundreds of old school desegregation cases that are still on dockets in courts across the country. But the rules of SWAN only apply to a finding of intentional discrimination by a school district or by a state. But they do still apply to those schools.
Let's get to a voicemail from one of our listeners. Elise in Myrtle Beach shared this note with us after she left a Kamala Harris campaign event.
I will say I live in South Carolina, and I was further inland than the beach when I was growing up. And I'm about 5 years younger than Senator Harris. I had a very important experience where my mother and I guess my teacher saw something in me, and they said, there's a better school for the sixth grade that you can attend than your local school, the one for which I was assigned in my Black community. And I went ahead. I went across town. I was the only person from my community who did that. And it was a good, good, good pivotal learning experience for me.
Elise, thank you for sharing your story with us. And, you know, a noted professor that she called her experience pivotal. Senator Harris noted that she achieved and excelled in life because of the early educational opportunities she got. Both Elise and Senator Harris were little Black girls at the time. So, Professor, how did Black students benefit from busing, benefit from the integration efforts that have already taken place?
Sure. We have a robust body of social science literature that shows a range of different benefits for Black students in particular who have been the most studied, that they achieved higher educational attainment, graduated from high school, were more likely to go on to college, have higher occupational aspirations, and that some of these were even perpetuating benefits so that they accrue to the second or even third generation. So I think the way that both she and Kamala and, you know, many people I saw on social media after that debate talked about, that was me, and that experience was really pivotal, I think is certainly borne out in what we see in the research. But I think it's also important to say that there are many of us who were white children who were part of desegregation, too. I was part of a desegregation in my district growing up, and that certainly has fueled my interest in studying this today. And I think we need to not overlook the fact that white students have a range of social and psychological benefits from integrated schools, too, that we don't see talked about as often, but is really important and goes back to some of the things that Dennis talked about in his own experience of going to a white segregated private school, that we all need to be preparing students for living in the diverse country and world that we're in. And that's a really pivotal time in elementary school, for example, when some of these ideas are still being shaped. And so the extent to which we can think about public schools, which are our most public institution, 90% of kids go to public schools, as a really important way to think about how to expose students across racial lines.
Dennis, I'd love you to respond to Sacco, who tweeted, "What about the notion that integration removed Black students from being taught by Black educators? If racism is structural, how could this play into removing Black students from safe environments to then be put in a class with majority white peers and teachers?" Dennis?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. You don't have to be in an all-Black school to be taught by a Black teacher. And I think one of the things that the school desegregation cases say is that you don't want to have schools that are identified as being white schools or Black schools. Now, that's not to say that any school district has enough representation in the teaching staff. Certainly not as much as they should have. It's important for white students also to see teachers of a whole range of races and ethnicities. And this is another example, and it's going back to what you had read earlier about the hostility that people faced in many cases when they were part of a desegregation programs. I think it's unfair to blame that experience on integration or on busing when the problem is the underlying racism. The problem is the inability of people to accept people who are different from themselves. And to think that by ending desegregation efforts that you're going to address that problem, I think is mistaken. And I think that as long as you think that the solution is to end busing, then you are you are focusing on a symptom and not focusing on the cause, which is that underlying segregation and the discrimination that still persists.
That kind of dovetails, Professor, into a voicemail we got from Andy in Louisville. He left us this note about his thoughts and experience.
I was a product of forced busing in the 70s and 80s. It was the worst thing. You know, I know it was done for integration within the city of Louisville, and it was supposed to be a marvelous thing. Here other people have had great experiences with it. Maybe they weren't forced to go someplace where you weren't wanted, and kids weren't forced to come into neighborhoods where they weren't necessarily wanted either. We had riots and all kinds of stuff the first year that this went on. I was not for forced busing at all.
Andy, thank you for sharing your story with us. Professor, it sounds like some of what he dealt with just had to do with the discomfort and the fear and, as he said, the violence that came along with merging these two groups of students. Is that just inherent to the process, or are there ways to make busing in particular less dramatic, less discomforting for the communities that are involved?
I think when I hear Andy's comments, I really think about the lack of constructive leadership that was certainly evident in that era. And Louisville is a really interesting story that I'll come back to in a minute. But to me, there was so much effort by local school districts to resist school desegregation, to submit plans that they knew wouldn't work or would cause the most chaos and disruption, so that then you could say, look, school desegregation or busing doesn't work, and then be done with it. And so to me, when I think back to really the experiences that people across the South in particular experience, and the North is a little bit of a different story, I think I look back and I wish our educational leaders, our community leaders, our politicians wouldn't have seen resisting school desegregation as the political opportunity that they did, and instead would have thought about, these are children, they only go through school once. How can we make sure, even if we don't agree with this, that we're structuring the schools so that they're as welcoming as possible, particularly for children who are coming from a different neighborhood or are leaving the school and community they once knew? And that's where principals and teachers are really important, other adults in the school, and also providing training. Now, Louisville is an example of a place that first bused across district boundary lines even to maintain segregation in the early 1970s. They then consolidated it into a countywide school district. There was violence initially when they put together a pretty complicated busing plan in the mid-1970s. But today, they're a district that is voluntarily busing children across the school district for integration because they believe that in the importance of the gains that the children and the community have gotten from integrated schools. And once they ended court oversight for desegregation in 2000, in the last 19 years, they have employed a number of different voluntary integration cases to integrate schools across the county, and is really one of the largest examples of a voluntary integration plan that's still going on today.
We actually heard from some of our listeners in Kentucky, including Rebecca, who tweeted, I was in public schools in Jefferson County, Kentucky. I remember violent anti-busing demonstrations. Our family supported busing. When we drove past angry protesters with honk if you're against busing signs, my dad refused to honk, and I was sure we would be attacked for it. Terrifying. Kevin wrote, I was in elementary school in Louisville, Kentucky during the 1970s, and I was terrified of busing. My family's fear was passed on to me. As a white kid, I was convinced that if I was sent to a black school, it would be a free-for-all. I have not thought about this since childhood, but the current discussion about busing has brought it to mind. What a warped view for a child to have. We will continue in just a moment with Professor Erica Frankenberg and Dennis Parker of the National Center for Law and Economic Justice. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the other factors affecting the quality of schools. We've heard from a number of our listeners about charter schools and school vouchers and how those factor into this larger idea of integration or what might be standing in the way. And I'd love to get your sense of what needs to be done now to finally, after 65 years, make good on the promise of Brown versus Board of Education, if we can. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Dennis Parker and Professor Erica Frankenberg. Dennis, you talked a little bit about how Northerners responded to busing. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that? What was going on in the North that was different from what was happening in the South?
Well, the big difference between the North and the South is that the Northern districts didn't have the same law that required segregation, but still did things which resulted in segregated schools. So it was harder to prove that there was intent to discriminate. But there were Northern cases. I was involved in one in Denver. I and Dr. Frankenberg have been working on one in the Hartford metropolitan area for 30 years, or at least I've been working for almost 30 years. There were cases certainly in Boston. I happened to be going to school in Boston right when school desegregation was going on. And I have to tell you, in a career of doing school desegregation cases in the South, I never encountered any general hostility and racism as severe as what I saw in Boston in the 70s in the South. And so that gives you an idea of how hard the resistance was. In my own county of Westchester, Yonkers had both a housing and a school desegregation case that was made necessary because of constant actions which were put in place to cause segregation in both housing and schools.
Now, Dennis, so, I hate to cut you off, but I know that you are blowing the minds of some of our more progressive listeners who are thinking that a place as urbane and cosmopolitan and worldly wise as New York or Boston or Los Angeles, these centers of thought and art and intellectual rigor should surely be more enlightened on things like school integration. And what you're saying is they're not, that it's a problem for everyone everywhere. And if you think that you're better because you're in the North, you're kidding yourself.
It's as depressing as hell.
Yeah, yeah. Does that make it harder in the North to do something about it because of that mentality that, oh, we couldn't possibly be doing that?
It makes it harder because in some cases people will describe themselves as being progressive, and so how could I be discriminatory? And there's so many forms that discrimination takes. It can be the intentional, you know, burning a bus in the South, or it could be implicit and unconscious bias that teaches you that students are more dangerous if they're black or brown. Much of my litigation, in addition to the school desegregation cases, has been litigation that looks at disparate punishment. And what we see is that black and brown students are disproportionately punished, are punished for things that white students aren't punished for, are given more severe punishment. And that happens in school districts all across the country. There's still an underlying problem. You know, as you read the accounts of people who talked about how horrible things were when they were in these schools that were desegregating, you have to remember that this is a country that had to fight its greatest war to decide the question of whether or not you can sell human beings. And the price that was paid and the number of lives that were lost didn't take care of the underlying problems. So that it's a little naive to think that things would go really smoothly in light of that history. And it's an indication that this is something that we have to work on, and all of us have to work on, whether you live in the Upper West Side of Manhattan or in Alabama. You have to think about your decisions. You know, people who move into gentrifying neighborhoods mm-hmm. but won't send their kids to schools where there are mostly black and brown students need to take a step back and think, why do I feel that?
Professor Frankenberg, what about anything you would add about that North-South divide or what it takes to kind of break through with school integration in the North versus the South? Anything you would add to that?
Just a couple of points I would make. One is, I think in our discussion over what are the tools to accomplish desegregation, which again was obviously a very necessary one given the massive resistance in the South in particular, we moved away from talking about why this matters. And so we moved away from talking about the importance of desegregated schools for all students. We didn't talk about the ways in which white supremacy or the legacies of segregation, enslavement, we're still perpetuating decades later, and the need to take overt actions. And so I think it's unfortunate that in talking about the tools, we lost some of the talking about the framing, which, of course, is important in the South, but also important in places like the North, who can say, well, at least I didn't send my child, we didn't have Black schools or something like that. And it wasn't overt, but they were still making moves in terms of using school choice or what kind of neighborhood they were moving to. There's so many fragmentation of school districts in the Northeast, for example, that create almost one race school districts. And so by moving, you're able to, in essence, move away from desegregation if you have the means to do so. And if you're white, you're not subject to the same kinds of housing discrimination. And so I think that there were really important ways in which this de facto segregation that manifested itself made it easy for Northerners to think that they weren't as bad as Southerners, when in fact, Southern schools by the early 1970s were much more desegregated than in the Northeast, a trend that is still true today.
Professor Frankenberg, can I jump in right there in terms of school choice? We got some questions about that, and I'd like to get your perspective on that. Let me read two quick comments. Harry writes, a significant factor in perpetuation of school segregation in Michigan is the promotion of charter schools at the expense of public schools. The major architect of this tectonic shift was Betsy DeVos, referring to the Secretary of Education. And Nancy asked, do we see legislators doing similar things to prevent integration today with creating vouchers and charter schools paid for by taxpayers? Professor?
So certainly in an unequal and segregated society, which we still have today, despite glacially slow progress in residential integration, we're going to have choices that are going to be unequal unless we take steps to try to constrain choices in ways that might provide more integration. So when we have a decentralized system like vouchers or charter schools, that may unintentionally aid those who have the resources to know about schools, to make the school choice. In some places, charter schools and vouchers don't provide transportation. So, of course, not all families are equally able to take advantage of that. And so I think it's really important to look very critically at the use of government funds for both charter schools and vouchers, and to think about the way in which that may be incentivizing segregation. There's also in Michigan, you can open enroll across school district boundary lines. Again, that's only available to families who have the means to do that and know about that legislation. And so there are a range of ways in which school choice, which certainly is a growing part of the discussion and has been supported by Republican and Democratic politicians alike, has been designed in ways that have not taken account of what we need to do in order to design it to be more equitable and provide access to all.
As we're winding down, Dennis, let me get a quick response to one more comment. Nancy emailed, I've never understood why all property taxes don't go into a single pool in any district to benefit all schools equally. Using homeowner taxes only in the area where the homes are perpetuates the basic inequality that results from lesser quality education when schools are deprived of funds. Dennis, a number of our listeners asked economic questions, just funding questions about school integration. Is there any way around integration being expensive, costing money? You know, you can have methods to move kids around and put teachers in different places, but the bottom line is that this is not going to come cheap.
Quality education, including integration, is not cheap. That's one of the most important things that the state does, is to educate children. And it costs money to do that. Sadly, the Supreme Court rejected a case in Texas, which looked at the role of funding formula in terms of giving different resources to different schools, and found that there wasn't a federal cause of action. There have been a number of cases in state courts that have required some sort of equity funding. But the fact is that good education costs. And I think it's important to recognize, some people will say, well, should we spend money on education or should we spend it on desegregation? And I would argue that those are not two different things, that they are connected, that a high quality of education is one that includes desegregation as one of its goals.
One more comment from a listener. Osmond tweeted, I'm not sure about the 70s, but we currently have the same in Lee County, Florida. Lee County is southwestern Florida. That's where Fort Myers is. My son spends almost an hour one way to and from school. It's painful for me and the kids. I prefer a system where education is brought to the people, not the other way around. As we're winding down, I asked you earlier to really kind of define what we mean by segregation. I wonder, Professor, what would integration look like? How would we know if we had actually succeeded?
Sure. I think that integration is where we have schools that are racially diverse, and there is racially diverse students as well as faculty.
Now, staff. Define diverse. I'm sorry to cut you short, but define diverse. Are you talking about a direct one-to-one proportion with the U.S. population, or what does that mean?
I think it's unrealistic, for example, for a student living in California to come to Central Pennsylvania for school in order to make schools perfectly reflect our public school enrollment, which today are a majority non-white. I think about it on a regional basis. Let's think about our region. We do a lot of other governmental services on region. How do we make our schools roughly reflective of the region we live in? How do we make sure that we have adults from all different races and ethnicities so that both white students and students of color are seeing role models across races? How do we make sure that the classrooms reflect the school enrollment, make sure that things like discipline are not disproportionately for students of color, that AP courses aren't disproportionately for white students. And so those are some of the things that I think that we would start to think about if we were truly getting integration to work. And I think that would then help our communities.
Dennis, when I was in high school, I did an experiment. The white kids used to sit on the north side of the cafeteria, and the black kids sat on the south side of the cafeteria. I went to Suncoast Community High School in Riviera Beach, Florida, which is one of the top high schools in the country. Big magnet school, very culturally diverse at that time. So I did an experiment. Instead of orienting the tables so that they were kind of perpendicular to the building, I turned them so they were parallel. So they were these long, long, long stretches of huge, long tables, just to see what it did to people. They sat in the exact same places on those tables. They adapted to the pattern. How do you break that pattern inside the school? Even if you have kids from different places who come together, that doesn't mean that they have to like each other or work together. How do you change that?
Well, there are a few things. Number one, you could never break the pattern if you have wholly segregated schools. Then there isn't even the opportunity to do that. But the other thing is that you need to look at all aspects of an educational experience. I bet if you looked at the football team that you saw people of different races interacting with each other, or girls soccer or any of the other sports. If the school is running well, the other activities should reflect that diversity. If I could answer and add on to what Erica said, I would consider successful desegregation as a program where, as used to happen in the cases that I did, not only in the South, but in the North, where you couldn't identify the honors class by the race of the kids who were sitting in the seats, where the people who were on the dance team or the cheerleader squad reflected the full diversity of the schools. Once you have that, once you have schools where everyone has their needs met and where every activity reflects the potential and the identity of all the students, that's successful desegregation.
And before we go, Professor, is there one thing that you would like everyday people to do, parents, teachers, you know, school supporters, alumni, to improve integration in our schools before we go?
Sure. I think as white people as well as people of color, we need to think about how our lives are reinforcing segregation and how we can make changes to produce more integration and push our legislatures and our politicians to do more, not just to try to divide us.
Erica Frankenberg is a professor of education and the director at the Center for Education and Civil Rights at Penn State University. Professor, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
And Dennis Parker is the executive director of the National Center for Law and Economic Justice. Dennis, thanks very much.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you also for sharing your stories with us. We'd love you to keep sharing them. Let us know what aspects of this huge issue you'd like us to tackle next. Also, do send us your questions for Governor Jay Inslee, 855-236-1A1A, or use our app, 1A Vox Pop. This conversation was produced by Morgan Givens. To learn more about him and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.